Hello and welcome to the Chime 30th Anniversary Podcast, where we are celebrating three decades of dedication to digital health leadership. I'm Russ Branzell, your host for this podcast and CEO and president of Chime. Each week until the Chime Fall Forum in San Antonio, Texas, we're going to be spending time with amazing digital health leaders who've made a very special impact on Chime. Today, we start at the very beginning. Our very first founding chair of Chime, who took office in 1992 and served all the way through 1993. If I read every bit of his bio, it would be the longest podcast in the history of Chime, but let's just suffice it to say, one of the greatest leaders we've ever seen in healthcare. Truly, when we give him the title of godfather of the role of CIO, it is not out of jest, but out of absolute respect for him and everything he has done. Currently, as he pretends to be retired, he is the current executive and resident at Harvard Medical School. Again, I would encourage you to look out on LinkedIn at all of his accolades and all the things that he has done in his career, including amazing positions across our entire industry. But most importantly for me personally, as the leader of this podcast today, a dear friend and mentor of mine. Welcome to the program, Dr. John Glasser. Welcome, John.
Russ, it's a pleasure as always to be here. Pleasure to spend time with you and all the Chime members.
Well, I will tell you, as we look back at history a little bit here, and you can go back way because you're a local Bostonian, we can go really far back and look at revolutionary times. But boy, I'll tell you what, you're part of those forefathers and leaders and folks that were really trying to change our industry now 30 years ago. It doesn't seem like that long ago, but it is. And what were some of your thoughts as you all were gathering and so many great leaders that maybe we need to do something industry and form this thing called Chime? And what should we be doing with it all the way 30 years ago?
Well, Russ, it's, you know, back in the early 1990s, so this is, you know, 1990, 91, 92, you know, this is sort of pre-internet, pre-mobile device. The technology was, you know, personal computers and mini computers, et cetera. And I think, frankly, with some exceptions, obviously, most of the healthcare CIO's role was to select the next departmental application. You had to do it and do it well, et cetera. But that was the role, very operational at a level. But at the same time, people were beginning to observe that IT could be used to really change industries and to form a basis of competition. So you saw this in organizations like Federal Express and Bank of America and USAA and Frito-Lay, et cetera. And one of the conversations that began to happen amongst those of us who were then at the time in the HIMSS leadership and also the high C leadership is that this was going to happen, needed to happen in healthcare. And so how are we going to help accelerate the progress and prepare the current leaders of IT in health organizations to assume this role, this new emerging strategic role? And so it was an outgrowth of some conversations that were occurring in the HIMSS board level. I was the chairman of the board of HIMSS in 1991. Rich Correll, who's the initial CEO of Chime, was also on that board along with Rich Riedel. And we began the conversations that said we need to create a group and a way to bring together this emerging community. HIMSS at the time was in a lot of trouble. It was frankly insolvent and couldn't pay attention to it. So with HIMSS' blessing, we went off to create Chime. So it was at this time where we began to see this movement from back office support, operational support, to really being strategic. You still have to do back office and still operational. But that was the juncture.
Was there kind of a vision of what you thought this could become even back then?
Oh, I don't know, Russ. Yes and no. I mean, I sometimes think, you know, and I was talking to my wife about this a while back, and, you know, now we have grandkids, and it was hard to imagine when we were first going out together at Duke that we would have had this vision of grandkids. Now, you know, at a level that can happen, but what it was really like and this, that, and the other, I think it's really hard to fathom. I think what we knew, and like a lot of things, in some ways, I think, Russ, the formula for Chime is pretty simple. You know, you bring together a set of individuals who have a common set of interests, a common profession. You help, you know, provide some educational material for them, but you give them a lot of time and opportunity to meet each other, to share, to learn from each other, to form relationships, et cetera. And then you also, knowing that we all head off sooner or later into the sunset, that you prepare the next generation to come. So you say, we're going to create a set of activities where we just bring the community together. Now, how that will evolve, don't know. You know, and along the way, Russ, in the first couple of years, there's a lot of very fundamental decisions that were made. It was, you know, in the beginning of the second year that in a conversation with Rich Correll and Mark Gross, and Mark Gross, who was with E&Y at the time and on the Chime board, said, why don't we found it? He said, let's start this thing called the Foundation. And that was created a couple of years later. The Information Management Executive course, which you took, evolved into the boot camp. So, you know, you start this thing going to the basic idea, very powerful idea, but basic. And along the way, you start creating all these specific programs and initiatives that have this way. But I think it's really hard at the beginning to know what a mature formal looks like. You know, you feel your way through that and hope you don't make too many mistakes along the way.
Yeah, it's interesting. You mentioned the IME series. That's our first connection. I remember the very first day, still fondly, of you up on stage and even our dear friend who recently passed away, Dave Garretts, and let him rest in peace. Mm-hmm. But boy, what a great leader that we all got to experience. And but now you think about it, the thousands, I mean, literally tens of thousands of people that have gone through these IME and now boot camp programs, which you were both part of. Mm-hmm. During these times, but now we have digital leaders all over the place, rural right. care, long-term care, nursing homes, you know, insurance. I mean, it's everywhere. It's changed so much, but, you know, so now the question is really, how do we meet the needs of a whole organization, whole industry that's really on this verge of, for lack of a better term, revolutionizing into digital health? Yeah.
Well, and I think, Russ, you know, it has. And I think just one of the really cool things about this is you look back and I don't know what the number is. We say, how many thousands of lives have we touched? And it's a lot. It's great. And they in turn touch their staff and they in turn influence their organizations and they in turn deliver better care to the community. So you see like this ripple, you know, going out across a pond. So that's just really, really neat. I mean, that's in some ways what you hope your life is full of is the ability to influence in a good way, you know, many, many, many people, et cetera. But you're right, it's becoming really diverse. And it's not only, and you know, to your point, Russ, and you've done more of this than certainly I did at the time, or we did at the time, which is go global and sort of look across a broader community in the Europe and Asia and the Middle East, et cetera. But it is very diverse. And so what you find is a couple of things. One is it will be challenging, frankly, to sort of bring this diversity together to find common set of things, because they can be really different. You say, but on the other hand, there's a core here, which, you know, you see across all entities and across all parts of the geography. How do you become a better leader? How do you bring together and mold a great team? How do you engage in strategy? What's the deal with AI? Is it going to be important or not important and things along those lines? You know, how do you make sure that implementations work really well? So there are some common challenges we all face. It doesn't matter whether you're in the US or the UK or whether you're in a big, you know, gazillion hospital health system or in a critical access hospital, there are common differences. The other thing that I think we'll increasingly find, Russ, and are finding already, is that for us to really solve the issues and the challenges that confront healthcare, it requires a big tent with lots of big individual actors coming together. So if we're going to really do a great job of engaging patients and coordinating care, that's not just a hospital thing. That's a hospital and physician practice and health plans. You know, you go down the list, health, you know, the life sciences guys, it's all of us to go off and do this, so tackling social determinants in an effective way. So increasingly the agenda has been shifting from what do I do in my organization to make it function and be more competitive to what do I do to help this ecosystem, this connected set of organizations function more as a system. I mean, we use the word system, but it's not always a system. But how do we get that to be? So I think there's a lot of common issues and challenges that we all have. And there's also increasingly this growing need to operate as a collective in order to solve the challenges that confront us.
One of the things, and you just mentioned this, is a little bit of looking back at history, being a little bit retrospective back and thinking through all of this. And I'd love to hear kind of your thoughts on the last 30 years, maybe a little bit about, you know, Chime in that perspective, but more importantly, the industry and the growth we've seen. And now really the humongous impact we can make. It's kind of that a little bit industry, but also for you, John, a little bit legacy, because I don't know if there's anybody, literally anybody in our industry that has a bigger legacy of not only individuals that are in the positions they are today, but also the impact you made in your leadership.
Well, I appreciate the compliment, Russ. And I frankly think, you know, and you know this too, you know, the Chime has had a very significant impact, you know, across the industry, you know, and it's better, a lot better because of Chime. And that's great. And yes, I had a part of it, but so did you. So did Rich Correll. So does Keith. So do all the board members. I mean, there's been some stunning and a just this nonstop you know, flood, a parade of talent that has been brought together. So we all did this in lots of ways, and, you know, but nonetheless, so there you go. I think it is a broad accomplishment that we share here. And I think that you know, history teaches us that certain, you know, first of all, you ought to respect history without being so, you know, sort of ankle chained to it, et cetera. It teaches us, obviously, that things change. I mean, you know, the technology's really changed. The sort of issues of payment have changed over the course of time, et cetera. You know, that being said, leadership hasn't. What it takes to be a great leader hasn't changed. What it takes to deliver great care, the human aspect of it hasn't changed, et cetera. So one of the things you see when you go back in history is that stuff that is just consistent. Every generation, it is consistently here. It's still a challenge to raise kids. I don't care whether you're doing it now or 500 years ago or 500 years from now. So I think one of it's from history is what is consistent here and what can we learn from prior efforts? We don't have to rediscover certain things because, you know, the people that preceded us tackled it and we can learn a lot from them. But on the other hand, obviously some things are different that we need to go through. This is a very complicated discussion, Russ, and about how to do this. I mean, I do think that, you know, I remember people saying, well, you know, how would you know if you had a good life? And all of us have to sort of decide how we want to, you know, be judged and whether we're living up to it. But one way to think about it is how many lives have you touched in a good way, whether it's your family or your profession, your church, you know, whatever it might happen to be. And if you could say, golly, I can't even count that high, then you did a good job, you know, on that thing. And that's the kind of history, I guess, in a way, is that lots of people are, you know, doing better because you were around.
With that being said, let's talk a little bit about our industry. Some would say that we're at an epiphic moment or a crossroads where things really do have the potential of radically changing in ways that maybe we've never seen before. And it's not just the technology, but really maybe even the business imperative now that we have to change to a different way of thinking. And I, you know, kind of asking bluntly, can the industry itself change and be ready to change in the way it should? We usually are pretty slow and dogmatic about getting to that change that needs to occur. Now, we proved we could do it fast if we had to. We did it during COVID. Yeah. But the question is, can the industry really change, or is it going to be disruptive from the outside?
Well, I think, you know, one of the questions, Russ, is to what degree is it disruptible? And so you can say, you know, actually, when people study this stuff, sociologists study this stuff, they look at, you know, very complex social economic industries. And that means that there's an economic basis for it. You got to make money or you're gone. But there's also a social mission where you do things because they're good for society. Healthcare is one of those. Education is one of those. Religion is one of those things. When you have complex social economic industries, they change slowly. And one of the reasons is because they have such social values and social missions that those actually don't always change as rapidly as you might like, et cetera. So education has not changed at warp speed. I mean, it has, but it hasn't. Neither has organized religion in some ways. So I sometimes think, and you get the Clayton Christensen disruptive innovation is, well, to what degree can you really disrupt healthcare in that way where there's just dramatic? Now, you said, but wait a minute, you know, on the pandemic, we certainly did shift gears. And yes, we did. So on the one hand, you hold off and say, golly, it's one of these classes of industry that's just really hard to change. It will change, but it's more like slower. It's like glaciers going through valley. On the other hand, when you study digital transformation, say, well, when transformations occur in industry, what causes them? You say, well, really, there's five factors, you know, that go after. One is, you know, organizations through their strategy say, we're going to do X, you know, we're going to have a continuum of care and away they go. That's one factor. The second is government steps in and says, we're changing the rules of the game. Here's how you're going to get paid, or, you know, we're going to have a national health system like you see in Europe, et cetera. The third is you get new entrants who come into the field and say, we're smart people. We're going to change, you know, we have some money too. We're going to change how you compete. So, you know, you look at the sector that makes movies, and all of a sudden you got, you know, the Hulus and the Amazons, you know, and the Netflix in there, you know, along with the Disneys and the United Artists, et cetera. So you get new entrants that come in. The next one, fourth, is new technology comes in. And so it can be digital technology, but in the past it was flight or refrigeration, et cetera. And then the last one is you get a crisis comes along, and all of a sudden, you know, and it could be a recession, it could be war, it could be a pandemic. So you say, golly, when industries change writ large, it's because one or more of these five factors are at play. And you say, well, how many are at play today? All of them. You say, wow, that's really unusual at the juncture of any industry to have all five factors at play. And it's not just healthcare. It's in the travel business and things along those lines. So you say, well, golly, you know, it may be hard to change. But boy, oh boy, if there is a sort of confluence of factors, now is the time. Now, will it? We'll see, Russ. And I think that's part of our collective effort is to understand how fast it can change and the sort of the nature of it, but also to keep pushing it and to seize opportunities that have confronted us because of the technology like AI or because of the speed up in decision making that happened during the pandemic. So I think it can. It's too early to tell. Major changes of industries take decades. And so it's not something you'll see necessarily in 2 years. But, you know, you and I, if we were to be chatting in 5 years, 10 years, we might turn back and say, wow, you know, look what really changed along the way.
Yeah, what's the saying is we always overestimate what will happen in 2 years and massively underestimate what will happen in 5 or 10.
Exactly.
That's probably what's going to happen to us. Well, besides everything else you do in the world, you are an amazing teacher, and you've done that in many different places, and now spending time at Harvard Medical School and helping there. Not only are you one of the most futuristic thought leaders in the entire industry, but you also get exposed to a lot of people out there who have really interesting and maybe innovative or break the system kind of thoughts. I'd love to hear some of your thoughts on maybe a few of those things that are coming that are exciting, maybe a little scary and disruptive as we move forward, that maybe are catalysts for major change in our industry.
Yeah, I think, Russ, I mean, it is a remarkable time, and I'm privileged to be around to see it and to be part of this thing. And it runs on a couple of different threads, you know, one of which obviously is the technology. And I think every 10 years, there's a sort of a class of technology that arrives that just changes the world. You know, in the 90s, it was the web. In the 2000s, it was the mobile device. In the 2100s, it was sort of the Internet of Things. And right now, I think it's AI. And I think we're really early, but boy, oh boy, the world is going to be different because of that. And that's just really exciting to go through and say, how do we make sure it happens in a good way, but also address certain problems like bias and algorithms that we might see along the way. So that's pretty darn neat. The second is what you see, and I particularly see this in the medical school executive education thing, is the broad understanding of the power of IT is really across the organization. When I got started, Russ, I remember having a discussion with the guy who was the CEO at Partners at the time and said, hey, listen, I just want to make sure that we, you know, the IT agenda matches the strategy. And how should you and I have a conversation to make sure that's the case? And he said, listen, all I need is for you to not screw up, okay? And that was it. You know, he didn't know about IT. He didn't want it to break, et cetera. But now you've got leadership that understands it. They've been through implementations. They grew up with it, et cetera. So we've got a set of leadership in organizations, but also in government that really understand the technology, understand it enough to make sure let's push it hard. And that's exciting. It's less of an uphill climb. Well, it's a different kind of climb. The third is you look at the amount of venture money that's going into all these startups. Say, wow, there's some really smart, innovative people going on there, and some really cool companies. Now, you know, not all of them will survive, but still, there's a level of innovation that is extraordinary that is occurring in this realm, and we've never seen anything like it. And we're also beginning to see, I think, Russ, and perhaps it was overdue, a more holistic understanding of those who we care for. They're not, yes, they're patients, but we tend to see patients as people who are broken. They're, you know, we got to fix them, you know, something wrong with them, et cetera. But now we understand, well, they're consumers, you know, they need experience. They'll make decisions. They are more than, they have clinical issues. They have issues about their, you know, circumstances of poverty or whether they're in a nutritional wasteland. You know, they have sort of genetic material that goes along with, maybe we'll discover that they're a gut biome has an influence on health. So we have a much more holistic understanding of the person that we are taking care for. And that's exciting. That's long overdue. So I think the technology is cool. The sort of business climate is cool. The innovation level is pretty neat. All of it is coming together to create this ferment. How it will work and what will play out of it, it's hard to know, but that's okay. You know, great things happen when there's kind of this swirly, difficult to discern set of things going on at the same time.
Well, we all get to walk in the footsteps of amazing people and kind of rest on the shoulders of giants like you. And truly, you are one of my heroes and one of my role models that I've tried to follow my entire career. But you had people as well. You had people that went in front of you. And I'd love to give you a chance maybe to reflect on some of those people that really were there for you, just like you've been there for me and so many others.
Well, thanks, Russ. And you're right. All of us have probably a small number of people who really shaped us along the way. And I thought person who I would put either at the top of the list or darn near close to it, I mean, parents aside, was Dick Nesson, who was the CEO of the Brigham and Women's Hospital when I first became CIO there. And prior to that, the Brigham and Women's Hospital was fundamentally insolvent and in big trouble. There was a Harvard School of Public Health case called "Will the Brigham Survive?" And because it was in a lot of trouble, and he saved it, and he turned it into one of the great academic medical centers on the planet. He was also years later, at the forefront of leading the efforts to create Partners Healthcare, which is now Mass General Brigham. So this, extraordinary leader. At the time, I was a brand new CIO. I was 32 years old, still had my umbilical cord attached, and didn't know, I'd never run anything. And Dick was terrific at taking me aside. He was not always the greatest public speaker, but one-on-one, I've never seen anybody as extraordinary as he was. So he shaped me and molded me and gave me the long leash and trusted me. So, Russ, at the time, we moved all the Brigham systems to this massive network of thousands of personal computers. People thought we were nuts, but it worked. And then we went after provider order entry. Remember what colleagues saying, there'll be blood on the streets. Well, there wasn't. But Dick trusted us to go let us go off and do this. So he was extraordinary in shaping me, shaping the industry. And remember, Russ, a couple of, maybe a decade ago, I know this. You're probably podcast people don't. I write a letter to my family every week and half for 35 years. And one of these letters was devoted to Dick because we had a retirement event for him. And I described how Dick had shaped me, taught me about how to take risk, taught me about how to build great teams, taught me how to deal with adversity, taught me a lot of things. And I remember saying at the end of this letter, that while I will miss Dick, in a way I wouldn't be able to miss him because, quote, Dick made sure to the degree that I was capable, much of what he is, I have become. He shaped me. And remember Russ writing that and leaving a copy of that on his desk. And he came into my office the next morning, closed the door and said, "You made my wife cry," which basically was him telling me I made him cry because he was just of that generation, which you just didn't express yourself. 3 months later, he died of a heart attack. So the point is he shaped me in ways like that. And I hope all of us have one or more individuals like that. But the others, if you do, tell them what they have meant to you, because what you don't want to do is wish you had, but you never got the opportunity. So anyway, Dick is like that. And I sure, Russ, you have your set. Maybe I'm on that list, but you'll have others, and all of us will. And all of us hope that as we sort of, pay forward, as it were, that we in turn have multiple people who would say that we shape them in big and little ways.
It's interesting. One of those life values I have is don't wait for the funeral to eulogize
someone. Yeah, sure. I'm with you. I remember Russ, presiding over an event for my father after he passed away, and a number of his friends came together, and there must have been 100 people in the room, and they took turns at the mic getting up, say, "Oh, I remember this story about George Glasser," and somebody said, "I remember this." And I thought, I haven't heard 80% of these stories. And when the event was done, I turned to them all and said, "Listen, this is great. I want you to make sure that you tell your children your stories so that what they don't do is have to hear them like I did when they passed away." You're absolutely right.
John, you've been very generous over the years with sharing your thoughts in publications, and it's not because you honored me with letting me write the foreword, but one of my favorite books still is Glasser on Healthcare IT. It was interesting. I reread the foreword that you let me write for that. And it was like, wow, every single word still is perfectly written for you. And part of that honoring you, who you are in the industry. But as much as you've done for technology, as much as you've done for the role of CIO, you've also been an amazing role model for people on how to be a great human being. And I'd love for you maybe to spend some time on those principles that, A, you want to be remembered for, from a human perspective, but also kind of the life values you've always tried to live by.
Oh, Russ, I think, I have, like you, the values that we all do of integrity and honesty, et cetera. I mean, I do think one of the things that I live by, and I think everybody should do this, is, sooner or later, we will all pass away. And, if you said, "I've got 5 minutes left, what is it that I want to say about my life? And when I look back, what would I want to say? And if I can say them, then I'll die with a smile." And I say, in my own version, there are 5 things that I'd want to be able to say. One is that I'm madly in love with my wife then as I am now. And, we've been together for 47 years and, just a great gift. I want to be able to say that. The second is that my 3 daughters, they're all grown up now with their own families, that they will have lives as blessed as mine. Their paths will be different than mine. But nonetheless, I've been blessed and I hope they are too. The third is that I hope I'm spared poverty or bigotry or crushing hatred or, great pain, et cetera. But if I'm not, I hope I deal with it with courage. And then the fourth is that the people I worked with will say that I inspired them and taught them and led them well. And then last but not least is that the industry that I served and that the organizations I serve will be better because I was here. You know, I don't expect that anybody will remember me 100 years from now. That won't matter. They'll be better. So I think, Russ, all of us ought to have that list, you know, and if you can live to that list, it's hard because you have to make trade-offs, you know, all the time between that, then that's good. I mean, that will mark the a life well lived.
Well, it's interesting you say that because I can't speak to some of those for you. You're going to have to check with your wife and your kids and that kind of fun stuff. But I will speak for the last one. The industry is not just a little better because John Glasser was part of it. It is absolutely where it is today because of John Glasser and the work you've done. It's interesting as I look at the vision statement of Chime, it absolutely is the personification of you. Exceptional leaders transforming health and care. And there's an entire legacy of people out there because you worked hard. You set an example for us. You challenged us. You occasionally kicked us in the butt, which we probably needed more than ever. But more importantly, you're just a great human that we can all follow and a great friend to so many of us. And John, on behalf of our entire industry, on behalf of 30 years of Chime success, it all took that seed that you planted. Thank you for everything you've done, and thank you for your friendship.
Well, Russ, it's a pleasure. Back at you, too. You're a great friend, a great colleague, and a great leader. So I want to thank you for all of that, and I appreciate all the nice things you said. And I look forward to seeing everybody at the 30th anniversary and, you know, celebrating and patting each other on the back, and rightfully so, you know, saluting our collective efforts. So thank you again for the opportunity to spend a little time with you. Always a pleasure. And again, look forward to seeing everybody later in the fall.
Again, thanks. And thanks for you, our listeners, for listening to this program of our special 30th anniversary series. As always, you can visit us at Spotify or chimecentral.org/media to listen to this and all of our podcasts from great top healthcare leaders. As always, please be safe out there. Take care of each other. It's not just for you that we got vaccinated and we're taking care of each other, but it's for all the people we love. Stay home if you can. Take care and God bless.